sounds. You love it for another reason, dear, and we both know it. You're the only girl out there with 8 boys, and none of them are as tough or as smart as you. And sexy. Don't forget sexy. The secretary laughed at the idea. No competition, dear. Those old goats can only dream about sex. And they went off out of the office down the hall, where they met Paul again. He rattled off some key points in the Sturdivant case as they rode the elevator to the 3rd floor where the courtroom was located. One lawyer might argue this, and the other might possibly argue that. Here are some questions to trip both of them. 3 blocks away from where Justice McCarthy assumed her position on the bench, a group of rather intense men and 2 women gathered to discuss her demise. They met in a windowless conference room in a nondescript building, one of many clustered near the state capitol, where countless civil servants and lobbyists ground out the work of running Mississippi. The meeting was hosted by Tony Zachary and Judicial Vision. The guests were the directors of other like-minded government relations firms, some with vague names that deflected categorization. Freedom Network, Market Partnership, Commerce Council, Enterprise Advocacy. Other names got right to the point. Citizens Opposed to Lawsuit Tyranny, COLT, Fair Litigation Association, Jury Watch, Tort Reform Committee of Mississippi, and the Old Guard was there, the associations representing the interests of banks, insurance, oil, medicine, manufacturing, retail, commerce, trade, and the best of our American way of life. In the murky world of legislative manipulation, where loyalties shift overnight and a friend can become an enemy by noon, the people in the room were known, at least to Tony Zachary, to be worthy of trust. "Ladies and gentlemen," Tony began, standing with a half-eaten croissant on a plate before him, "the purpose of this meeting is to inform you that we will remove Sheila McCarthy from the Supreme Court in November, and her replacement will be a young justice committed to economic growth and limited liability." There was light applause around the table. Everyone else was seated, all curious and listening. No one was certain who was behind Judicial Vision. Zachary had been around a few years and had a fair reputation, but he had no personal money. Nor did his group have much of a membership. Nor had he ever shown much interest in the civil justice system. His newfound passion for changing liability laws seemed to spring from nowhere. But there was no doubt that Zachary and Judicial Vision were well-funded, and in their game, that meant everything. "We have the initial financing on the table, with more committed down the road," he said proudly. "More, of course, will be needed from you. We have a campaign plan, a strategy, and we, Judicial Vision, will be running the show." More applause. The biggest obstacle was always coordination. There were so many groups, so many issues, so many egos. Raising the money was easy, from their side of the street anyway, but spending it wisely was often the challenge. The fact that Tony had rather aggressively assumed control was wonderful news. The rest of them were more than content to write the checks and turn out the voters. "What about a candidate?" someone asked. Tony smiled and said, "You'll love him. Can't give you his name right now, but you'll love him. Made for television." Ron Fisk had not yet said yes to the campaign, but Tony knew that he would. And if for some reason he did not, there were more names on the list. They would indeed have themselves a candidate, and soon, even if it took sackfuls of cash. "Shall we talk money?" Tony asked, then plunged headlong into the issue before anyone could respond. "We have $1 million on the table. I want to spend more than both candidates spent in the last contested race. That was 2 years ago. And I don't need to remind you that your boy in that race came up short. My boy in this race will not lose. To guarantee this, I need $2 million from you and your members." $3 million for such a race was a shock. In the last governor's race, a a race that covered all 82 counties and not just a third of them, the winner spent $7 million and the loser spent half that. And a good governor's race was always a major spectacle, the centerpiece of state politics. Passions were high, turnouts even higher. A race for a seat on the Supreme Court, when one did occur, seldom drew more than a third of the registered voters. "How do you plan to spend $3 million?" someone asked. It was telling that the question was not about raising so much money. It was assumed they had access to pockets deep enough. "Television, television, television," Tony responded. This was partly true. Tony would never reveal his entire strategy. He and Mr. Reinhart planned to spend a lot more than $3 million, but many of their expenditures would be either in cash or carefully hidden out of state. An assistant popped up and began passing around thick folders. "This is what we've done in other states," Tony was saying. "Please take it with you and read it at your leisure." There were questions about his plan and more about his candidate. Tony revealed little, but continually emphasized his need for their financial commitments. The sooner, the better. The only blip in the meeting came when the director of Colt informed them that his group had been actively recruiting candidates to run against McCarthy and that he himself had a plan to take her out. Colt advertised 8,000 members, though that number was dubious. Most of its activists were ex-litigants who had been burned in a lawsuit of some variety. The organization had credibility, but it did not have $1 million. After a brief but tense flare-up, Tony invited the Colt guy to go run his own campaign, at which time he backed down quickly and rejoined ranks. Before adjourning, Tony urged secrecy, a vital element of the campaign. "If the trial lawyers find out that we have a horse in the race, they will crank up their fundraising machine. They beat you the last time." They were irked by this second reference to their loss in the last race, as if they would have won if only they had had Tony. But everyone let it pass. The mere mention of the trial lawyers immediately refocused their attention. They were too excited about the race to bicker. The class action claimed to include over 300 victims injured in various ways by the gross negligence of Crane Chemical at its Bowmore plant. Only 20 were named as plaintiffs, and of these 20, perhaps half had significant afflictions. Whether their ailments were linked to polluted groundwater would be a question for another day. It was filed in Hattiesburg at the federal courthouse, a good stone's throw from the Forest County Circuit Court building, where Dr. Leona Rocha and her jury had rendered its verdict barely 2 months earlier. Lawyers Sterling Bentz of Philadelphia and F. Clyde Hardin of Bowmore were on hand to do the filing, and also to chat with any reporters who had responded to their pre-filing press alert. Sadly, there were no television cameras, only a couple of green print reporters. At least for F. Clyde, though, it was an adventure. He hadn't been near a federal courthouse in over 30 years. For Mr. Bentz, the pathetic lack of recognition was appalling. He had dreamed of huge headlines and long stories with splendid photographs. He had filed many important class actions and had usually managed to get them adequately covered by the media. What was wrong with rural Mississippians? F. Clyde hurried back to Bowmore, to his office, where Miriam was lingering to see how things went.
"What channel?" she asked.
"None."
"What?"
It was without a doubt the biggest day in the history of the firm of F. Clyde Hardin and Associates, and Miriam couldn't wait to watch it all on television.
"We decided not to deal with those reporters. Can't trust them,"
F. Clyde explained as he glanced at his watch. It was 5:15, past time for Miriam to leave the office.
"No need to stick around," he said, flinging his jacket. "I've got things under control here."
She quickly left, disappointed, and F. Clyde went straight for the office bottle. The chilled, thick vodka soothed him immediately, and he began to replay his big day. With a bit of luck, the Hattiesburg paper would include his photo. Bentz was claiming 300 clients at $500 each F. Clyde was due a nice referral fee. So far, he'd been paid only $3,500, most of which he used for back taxes. He poured a second drink and said, "What the hell?" Bence wouldn't screw him, because he needed him. He, F. Clyde Hardin, was now an attorney of record in one of the most important class action cases in the country. All roads ran through Bowmore, and F. Clyde was the man. Chapter 13. It was explained to his firm that Mr. Fisk would be in Jackson for the entire day, something to do with personal business. In other words, don't ask. As a partner, he had earned the right to come and go as he pleased, though Fisk was so disciplined and organized that anyone in the firm could usually find him within 5 minutes. He left his wife on the front steps at dawn. Doreen was invited to make the trip, but with a job and 3 kids, it simply wasn't possible, not with such short notice. Ron left the house without breakfast, not that time was a factor. Tony Zachary had said, "We'll eat on the plane," and this was enough to entice Ron to skip his bran flakes. The Brookhaven airstrip was too small for the jet, so Ron happily agreed to rush off to the airport in Jackson. He had never been within 100 yards of a private jet and had never given much thought to flying in one. Tony Zachary was waiting at the general aviation terminal with a hearty handshake and a vigorous, "Good morning, Your Honor." They walked purposefully across the tarmac, past a few old turboprops and pistons, smaller, inferior vessels. Waiting in the distance was a magnificent carrier, as sleek and exotic as a spaceship. Its navigation lights were flickering. Its handsome stairway was extended down, a splendid invitation to its special passengers. Ron followed Tony up the steps to the landing, where a pretty flight attendant in a short skirt welcomed them aboard, took their jackets, and showed them their selection of seats.
"Ever been on a Gulfstream before?" Tony asked as they settled in.
One of the pilots said hello as he pushed a button to retract the stairway. "No," Ron said, gawking at the polished mahogany and soft leather and gold trimmings.
"This is a G5, the Mercedes of private jets. This one could take us to Paris nonstop."
"Then let's go to Paris instead of Washington," Ron thought, as he leaned into the aisle to absorb the length and size of the airplane. A quick count revealed seating for at least a dozen pampered folks. "It's beautiful," he said. He wanted to ask who owned it, who was paying for the trip, who was behind this gold-plated recruitment. But to inquire would be rude, he told himself. Just relax, enjoy the trip, enjoy the day, and remember all the details because Doreen will want to hear them. The flight attendant was back. She explained emergency procedures, then asked what they might like for breakfast. Tony wanted scrambled eggs, bacon, and hash browns. Ron ordered the same.
"Bathroom and kitchen are in the back," Tony said,
as if he traveled by G5 every day.
"The sofa pulls out if you need a nap."
Coffee arrived as they began to taxi. The flight attendant offered a variety of newspapers. Tony grabbed one, yanked it open, waited a few seconds, then asked,
"You keeping up with that Bowmore litigation?"
Ron pretended to look at a newspaper as he continued to soak in the luxury of the jet. "Somewhat," he said.
"They filed a class action yesterday," Tony said in disgust. "One of those national tort firms out of Philadelphia. I guess the vultures have arrived."
This was his first comment to Ron on the subject, but it definitely would not be his last. The G5 took off. It was one of 3 owned by various entities controlled by the Trudeau Group and leased through a separate charter company that made it impossible to track the true owner. Ron watched the city of Jackson disappear below him. Minutes later, when they leveled off at 41,000 feet, he could smell the rich aroma of bacon in the skillet. At Dulles General Aviation, they were whisked into the rear of a long black limo, and 40 minutes later, they were in the district, on K Street. Tony explained en route that they had a 10 a.m. meeting with one group of potential backers, then a quiet lunch, then a 2 p.m. meeting with another group. Ron would be home in time for dinner. He was almost dizzy from the excitement of such luxurious travel and feeling so important. On the 7th floor of a new building, they stepped into the rather plain lobby of the American Family Alliance and spoke to an even plainer receptionist. Tony's summary on the jet had been, "This group is perhaps the most powerful of all the conservative Christian advocates. Lots of members, lots of cash, lots of clout. The Washington politicians love them and fear them. Run by a man named Walter Utley, a former congressman who got fed up with all the liberals in Congress and left to form his own group." Fisk had heard of Walter Utley and his American Family Alliance. They were escorted into a large conference room where Mr. Utley himself was waiting with a warm smile and handshake and several introductions to other men, all of whom had been included in Tony's briefing on the jet. They represented such groups as Prayer Partnership, Global Light, Family Roundtable, Evangelical Initiative, and a few others, all significant players in national politics, according to Tony. They settled around the table behind notepads and briefing papers, as if they were about to place Mr. Fisk under oath and take his deposition. Tony led off with a summary of the Supreme Court of Mississippi and kept his comments generally positive. Most of the judges were good men with solid voting records, but of course there was the matter of Justice Sheila McCarthy and her closet liberalism. She couldn't be trusted on the issues. She was divorced. She was rumored to have loose morals, but Tony stopped without going into specifics. To challenge her, they needed Ron here to step forward and answer the bell. Tony ran through a quick biography of their man, and in doing so, did not offer a single fact that was not already known by those present. He handed off to Ron, who cleared his throat and thanked them for the invitation. He began talking about his life, education, upbringing, parents, wife, and kids. He was a devout Christian, a deacon in St. Luke's Baptist Church, a Sunday school teacher, Rotary Club, Ducks Unlimited, Youth League baseball coach. He stretched his resume as far as he could, then shrugged as if to say, "There's nothing else." He and his wife had been praying about this decision. They had even met with their pastor for yet more prayer, hopefully at a higher level. They were comfortable. They were ready. Everyone was still warm, friendly, delighted he was there. They asked about his background. Was there anything back there that could haunt him? An affair? A DUI? A stupid fraternity prank in college? Any ethics complaints? First and only marriage? Yes, good, we thought so. Any claims of sexual harassment from your staff? Anything like that? Anything whatsoever to do with sex? Because sex is the killer in a hot campaign. And while they were on the subject, what about gays? Gay marriage? Absolutely not. Civil unions? No, sir. Not in Mississippi. Gays adopting children? No, sir. Abortion? Opposed. All abortions? Opposed. Death penalty? Very much in favor. No one seemed to grasp the contradiction between the two. Guns, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and so on? Ron loved his guns, but was curious for a second about why these religious men were concerned about weapons. Then it hit him. It's all about politics and getting elected. His lifetime of hunting pleased them mightily, and he dragged it out as much as possible. No animal seemed safe. Then the squeaky-voiced director of the Family Roundtable pursued a line of questions dealing with the separation of church and state, and everybody seemed to nod off. Ron held his ground, answering thoughtfully, and seemed to satisfy those few who were listening. He also began to realize that it was all a show. Their minds had been made up long before he left Brookhaven that morning. He was their man, and at the moment, he was simply preaching to the choir. The next round of questions dealt with freedom of speech, especially religious speech. "Should a small-town judge be allowed to hang the Ten Commandments in his courtroom?" was the question. Ron sensed that this issue intrigued them, and he was at first inclined to be perfectly honest and say no. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that it's a violation of the separation of church and state, and Ron happened to agree. He did not, however, want to upset the party, so he said, "One of my heroes is my local circuit court judge in Brookhaven." He began to bob and weave. "A great man. He's had the Ten Commandments hanging on his wall for 30 years, and I've always admired him." A slick non-answer that they recognized for what it was. They also recognized that it was a fine example of slickness that could help Mr. Fisk survive a heated campaign. So there was no follow-up, no objection. They were, after all, battle-tested political operatives, and they could appreciate a savvy non-response when they heard one. After an hour, Walter Utley glanced at his watch and announced that he was a bit behind schedule. The day held many more important meetings. He concluded the little meet-and-greet with a declaration that he was very impressed with Ron Fisk and saw no reason why his American Family Alliance could not only endorse him, but hit the ground running down there and get some votes. Everyone nodded around the table, and Tony Zachary seemed as proud as a new father. "There's been a change in our lunch plans," he said when they were once again tucked away in the limo. "Senator Rudd would like to see you."
"Senator Rudd?" Fisk asked in disbelief.
"You got it," Tony said proudly.
Myers Rudd was halfway through his 7th term, 39 years, in the U.S. Senate, and for at least the last 3 elections, he had scared away all opposition. He was despised by at least 40% of the people and loved by at least 60%, and he had perfected the art of helping those on his side of the street and dismissing all others. He was a legend in Mississippi politics, the fixer, the inveterate meddler in local races, the king who picked his candidates, the assassin who slaughtered those who ran against his candidates, the bank who could finance any race and funnel hordes of cash, the wise old man who led his party, and the thug who destroyed the others.
"Senator Rudd has an interest in this case?" Fisk asked so innocently.
Tony gave him a wary look.
How naive can one be?
"Of course he does.
Senator Rudd is very close to those folks you just met. He maintains a perfect voting record in their scorebooks. Perfect, mind you. Not 95%, but perfect. One of only 3 in the Senate, and the other 2 are rookies."
What will Doreen say about this, Ron thought to himself. Lunch with Senator Rudd in Washington. They were somewhere near the Capitol when the limo ducked into a one-way street.
"Let's jump out here," Tony said before the driver could get out.
They headed for a narrow door next to an old hotel called the Mercury. An ancient doorman in a green uniform frowned as they approached.
"To see Senator Rudd," Tony said abruptly,
and the frown lessened somewhat. Inside, they were led along the edge of an empty and gloomy dining room and down a passageway.
"It's the senator's private quarters,"
Tony said quietly. Ron was greatly impressed. He was noticing the worn carpet and peeling paint, but the old building had a strong dose of shabby elegance. It had a history. How many deals have been put together inside these walls, he asked himself. At the end of the hallway, they walked into a small private dining room where all manner of serious power was on display. Senator Rudd was seated at the small table, cell phone stuck to his head. Ron had never met him, but he certainly looked familiar. Dark suit, red tie, thick, shiny gray hair plastered to the left and held in place with no small amount of spray. Large, round face that seemed to grow thicker each year. No fewer than 4 of his minders and handlers were hovering like bees, all engaged in urgent cell phone chats, probably with one another. Tony and Fisk waited, watching the show. Government in action. Suddenly, the senator slapped his phone shut, and the other 4 conversations were instantly concluded.
"Clear out," the great man grunted, and his minions fled like mice. "How are you, Zachary?"
he said, standing behind the table. Introductions were made, small talk pursued for a moment. Rudd seemed to know everyone back home in Brookhaven. An aunt once lived there, and he was honored to meet this Mr. Fisk that he had heard so much about. At some predetermined point, Tony said,
"I'll be back in an hour,"
and vanished. He was replaced by a waiter in a tuxedo.
"Sit down," Rudd insisted. "The food's not much, but the privacy is great. I eat here 5 times a week.
The waiter ignored the comment and handed over menus. "It's lovely," Ron said, looking around at the walls lined with books that had been neither read nor dusted in 100 years. They were dining in a small library. No wonder it's so private. They ordered soup and grilled swordfish. The waiter closed the door when he left.
"I have a meeting at 1, Rudd said, "so let's talk fast."
He began pouring sugar into his iced tea and stirring it with a soup spoon. "Certainly."
"You can win this race, Ron, and God knows we need you."
Words from the king, and hours later, Ron would quote them over and over to Doreen. It was a guarantee from a man who had never lost. And from that opening volley, Ron Fisk was a candidate. "As you know," Rudd continued, because he really wasn't accustomed to listening, especially in conversations with small-time politicians from back home,
"I don't get involved in local races."
Fisk's first impulse was to laugh, and loudly, but he quickly realized that the senator was dead serious.
"However, this race is too important. I'll do what I can, which is nothing to sneeze at, you know."
"Of course.
I've made some powerful friends in this business, and they will be happy to support your campaign. Just takes a phone call from me."
Ron was nodding politely. 2 months earlier, Newsweek ran a cover story on the mountains of special interest cash in Washington and the politicians who took it. Rudd topped the list. He had over $11 million in his campaign war chest, yet had no foreseeable race. The notion of a viable opponent was too ridiculous to even consider. Big business owned him. Banks, insurance, oil, coal, media, defense, pharmaceuticals. No segment of corporate America had escaped the tentacles of his fundraising machine. "Thank you," Ron said because he felt obligated.
"My folks can put together a lot of money. Plus, I know the people in the trenches. The governor, the legislators, the mayors. Ever hear of Willie Tate Ferris?"
"No, sir."
"He's a supervisor. Beat 4, Adams County, in your district. I kept his brother out of prison. Twice. Willie Tate will walk the streets for me. And he is the most powerful politician in those parts. One phone call from me, and you got Adams County."
He snapped his fingers. Just like that, the votes were falling in place.
"Ever hear of Link Kaiser, sheriff in Wayne County?"
"Maybe."
"Link's an old friend. 2 years ago, he needed new patrol cars, new radios, new bulletproof vests and guns and everything. County wouldn't give him crap, so he calls me. I go to Homeland Security, talk to some friends, twist some arms, and Wayne County suddenly gets $6 million to fight terrorism. They got more patrol cars than they got cops to drive them. Their radio system is better than the Navy's. And lo and behold, the terrorists have decided to stay the hell out of Wayne County."
He laughed at his own punchline, and Ron was obliged to guffaw along with him. Nothing like wasting a few more million tax dollars.
"You need Link? You got Link and Wayne County," Rudd promised as he slugged down some tea.
With 2 counties under his belt, Ron began contemplating the other 25 in the Southern District. Would the next hour be spent listening to war stories from all of them? He rather hoped not. The soup arrived.
"This gal McCarthy," Rudd said between slurps, "she's never been on board."
Which Ron took as an indictment on the grounds of not supporting Senator Rudd.
"She's too liberal. Plus, between us boys, she just ain't cut out for the black robe. Know what I mean?"
Ron nodded slightly as he studied his soup. Little wonder the senator preferred dining in private. "He doesn't know her first name," Ron said to himself. "He knows very little about her, except that she is indeed female, and in his opinion, out of place." To ease things away from the good old white boy talk, Ron decided to interject a semi-intelligent question.
What about the Gulf Coast? I have very few contacts down there. Predictably, Rudd scoffed at the question. No problem.
My wife's from Pas Cristian,
he said, as if that alone could guarantee a landslide for his chosen one.
You got those defense contractors, naval shipyards, NASA. Hell, I own those people.
And they probably own you, Ron thought, sort of a joint ownership. A cell phone hummed next to the senator's tea glass. He glanced at it, frowned, and said,
Gotta take this. It's the White House.
He gave the impression of being quite irritated. Should I step outside? Ron asked, at once impressed beyond words, but also horrified that he might eavesdrop on some crucial matter.
No,
Rudd said as he waved him down. Fisk tried to concentrate on his soup and tea and roll, and though it was a lunch he would never forget, he suddenly wished it would quickly come to an end. The phone call did not. Rudd grunted and mumbled and gave no clue as to which crisis he was averting. The waiter returned with the swordfish, which sizzled a bit at first but soon cooled off. The white beets beside it were swimming in a large pool of butter. When the world was safe again, Rudd hung up and stuck a fork into the center of his swordfish.
Sorry about that, he said. Damn Russians. Anyway, I want you to run, Ron. It's important to the state. We have got to get our court in line.
Yes, sir, but...
And you have my complete support. Nothing public, mind you, but I'll work my ass off in the background. I'll raise serious cash, I'll crack the whip, break some arms, the usual routine down there. It's my game, son. Trust me. What if no one beats me in Mississippi? Just ask the governor. He was 20 points down with 2 months to go and was trying to do it himself. Didn't need my help. I flew down, had a prayer meeting. The boy got converted and he won in a landslide. I don't like to get involved down there, but I will. And this race is that important. Can you do it?
I think so.
Don't be silly, Ron. This is a one-time chance to do something great. Think of it. You at the age of,
39.
39, damned young, but you're on the Supreme Court of Mississippi, and once we get you there, you'll never leave. Just think about it.
I'm thinking very hard, sir.
Good.
The phone hummed again, probably the president.
Sorry,
Rudd said as he stuck it in his ear and took a huge bite of fish. The third and final stop on the tour was at the office of the Tort Reform Network on Connecticut Avenue. With Tony back in charge, they blitzed through the introductions and short speeches. Fisk answered a few benign questions, much lighter fare than what had been served up by the religious boys that morning. Once again, he was overwhelmed by the impression that everyone was going through the motions. It was important for them to touch and hear their candidate, but there seemed to be little interest in a serious evaluation. They were relying on Tony, and since he had found his man, so had they. Unknown to Ron Fisk, the entire 40-minute meeting was captured by a hidden camera and sent upstairs to a small media room where Barry Reinhart was watching carefully. He had a thick file on Fisk, one with photos and various summaries, but he was anxious to hear his voice, watch his eyes and hands, listen to his answers. Was he photogenic, telegenic, well-dressed, handsome enough? Was his voice reassuring, trustworthy? Did he sound intelligent or dull? Was he nervous in front of such a group, or calm and confident? Could he be packaged and properly marketed? After 15 minutes, Barry was convinced. The only negative was a hint of nervousness, but then that was to be expected. Yank a man out of Brookhaven and thrust him before a strange crowd in a strange city, and he's likely to stutter a few times. Nice voice. Nice face. Decent suit. Barry had certainly worked with less. He would never meet Ron Fisk, and as in all of Barry's campaigns, the candidate would never have the slightest clue about who was pulling the strings. Flying home, Tony ordered a whiskey sour and tried to force a drink on Ron, who declined and stuck with coffee. It was the perfect setting for a drink,
aboard a luxurious jet with a gorgeous young lady as the bartender at the end of a long and stressful day with no one in the world watching and knowing.
Just coffee, Ron said.
Regardless of the setting, he knew he was still being evaluated. Plus, he was a teetotaler anyway. The decision was easy. Not that Tony was much of a drinker. He took a few sips of his cocktail, loosened his tie, settled deep into his seat, and eventually said,
"Rumor has it that this McCarthy gal hits the booze pretty hard."
Ron simply shrugged. The rumor had not made its way to Brookhaven. He figured that at least 50% of the people there couldn't name any of the three justices from the Southern District, let alone their habits, good or bad. Another sip, and Tony kept going.
"Both of her parents were heavy drinkers. Of course, they're from the coast, so that's not unexpected. Her favorite hangout is a club called Tuesdays near the reservoir. Ever hear of it?"
"No."
"Kind of a meat market for the middle-aged swingers, so I hear. Never been there myself."
Fisk refused to take the bait. Such low gossip seemed to bore him. This didn't bother Tony. In fact, he found it admirable. Let the candidate keep the high ground. The mud would be slung by others.
"How long have you known Senator Rudd?" Fisk asked, changing the subject.
"A long time."
And for the remainder of the short trip, they talked about their great senator and his colorful career. Ron raced home, still floating from such a heady encounter with power and its trappings. Doreen was waiting for the details. They ate warmed-up spaghetti while the kids finished homework and prepared for bed. She had many questions, and Ron struggled with some of the answers. Why were so many diverse groups willing to spend so much on an unknown and thoroughly inexperienced politician? Because they were committed. Because they preferred bright, clean-cut young men with the right beliefs and without the baggage of prior service. And if Ron said no, they would find another candidate just like him. They were determined to win, to clean up the court. It was a national movement and a critical one. The fact that her husband had dined alone with Senator Myers Rudd was the clincher. They would take a dramatic plunge into the unknown world of politics, and they would conquer. Chapter 14. Barry Reinhart took the shuttle to LaGuardia, and from there a private car to the Mercer Hotel in Soho. He checked in, showered, and changed into a heavier wool suit because snow was expected. He picked up a fax at the front desk, then walked 8 blocks to a tiny Vietnamese restaurant near the village, one that had yet to appear in the travel guides. Mr. Trudeau preferred it for discreet meetings. It was empty and he was early, so Barry settled himself onto a bar stool and ordered a drink. F. Clyde Hardin's cheap class action may have been small news in Mississippi, but it was a far better story in New York. The daily financial publications ran with it, and the battered shares of Crane's common stock took another drubbing. Mr. Trudeau had spent the day working the phones and yelling at Bobby Ratzlaff. Crane's stock had been trading between $18 and $20, but the class action knocked it back a few bucks. It closed at $14.50, a new low, and Carl pretended to be upset. Ratzlaff, who had borrowed $1 million from his retirement fund, seemed even more depressed. The lower, the better. Carl wanted the stock to fall as far as possible. He had already lost $1 billion on paper, and he could lose more, because one day it would all come roaring back. Unknown to anyone except two bankers in Zurich, Carl was already buying Crane's stock through a wonderfully nebulous company in Panama. He was carefully gathering shares in small lots so that his buying would not upset the downward trend. 5,000 shares on a slow day and 20,000 on a busy one, but nothing that would draw attention. Fourth quarter earnings were due soon, and Carl had been cooking the books since Christmas. The stock would continue to slide, Carl would continue to buy. He sent Ratzlaff away after dark, then returned a few calls. At 7, he crawled into the back seat of his Bentley, and Tolliver drove him to the Vietnamese place. Carl had not seen Reinhardt since their first meeting in Boca Raton back in November, 3 days after the verdict. They did not use regular mail, email, faxes, overnight parcels, landlines, or standard cell phones. Each had a secure smartphone that was linked solely to the other, and once a week, when Carl had the time, he called for an update. They were led through a bamboo curtain to a dimly lit side room with one table. A waiter brought drinks. Carl was going through the motions of cursing class actions and the lawyers who bring them.
"We're down to nosebleeds and skin rashes," he said. "Every redneck who ever drove by the plant down there is suddenly a plaintiff. No one remembers the good old days, when we paid the highest wages in South Mississippi. Now the lawyers have created a stampede, and it's a race to the courthouse."
"It could get worse," Barry said. "We know of another group of lawyers who are rounding up clients. If they file, then their class will be added to the first one."
"I wouldn't sweat it." "You wouldn't sweat it. You're not burning cash in legal fees. You're gonna get it back, Carl. Relax."
It was now Carl and Barry, first names and lots of familiarity.
"Relax. Crane closed today at $14.50. If you owned 25 million shares, you might find it hard to relax."
"I would be relaxed, and I would be buying."
Carl knocked back his scotch.
"You're getting pretty cocky."
"I saw our boy today. He made the rounds in Washington. Nice-looking fellow. So clean-cut it's frightening. Smart, good speaker, handles himself well. Everybody was impressed."
"Has he signed on?"
"He will tomorrow. He had lunch with Senator Rudd, and the old boy knows how to twist arms."
"Myers Rudd," Carl said, shaking his head. "What a fool."
"Indeed, but he can always be bought."
"They can all be bought. I spent over $4 million last year in Washington, sprinkled it around like Christmas candy.
And I'm sure Rudd got his share. You and I know he's a moron, but the people in Mississippi don't. He's the king, and they worship him down there. If he wants our boy to run, then the race is on."
Carl squirmed out of his jacket and flung it across a chair. He removed his cufflinks, rolled up his sleeves, and with no one to watch, loosened his tie and slouched in his chair. He sipped his scotch.
"Do you know the story about Senator Rudd and the EPA?
He asked with full knowledge that fewer than 5 people knew the details.
"No,"
Barry said, tugging at his own tie.
7, maybe 8 years ago, before the lawsuit started, the EPA came to Bowmore and started their mischief. The locals there had been complaining for years, but EPA is not known for swift action. They poked around, ran some tests, became somewhat alarmed, then got pretty agitated. We were watching all this very closely. We have people all over the place. Hell, we have people inside the EPA. Maybe we cut some corners with our waste, I don't know. But the bureaucrats really became aggressive. They were talking about criminal investigations, calling in the U.S. attorney, bad stuff, but still kept internal. They were on the verge of going public with all sorts of demands, a $1 zillion cleanup, horrendous fines, maybe even a shutdown. A man named Gabbard was CEO of Crane at the time. He's gone now, but a decent sort who knew how to persuade. I sent Gabbard to Washington with a blank check, several blank checks. He got with our lobbyists and set up a new PAC, another one that supposedly worked to further the interests of chemical and plastics manufacturers. They mapped out a plan, the key to which was getting Senator Rudd on our side. They're scared of him down there, and if he wants the EPA to get lost, then you can forget the EPA. Rudd's been on the Appropriations Committee for 100 years, and if EPA threatens to buck him, then he simply threatens to cut their funding. It's complicated, but it's also very simple. Plus, this is Mississippi, Rudd's backyard, and he had more contacts and clout than anyone else. So our boys at the new PAC wined and dined Rudd, and he knew exactly what was happening. He's a simpleton, but he's played the game for so long, he's written most of the rules. Platters of shrimp and noodles arrived, and were casually ignored. Another round of drinks. Rudd finally decided that he needed $1 million for his campaign account, and we agreed to route it through all the dummy corporations and fronts that you guys used to hide it. Congress has made it legal, but it would otherwise be known as bribery. Then Rudd wanted something else. Turns out he's got this slightly retarded grandson who has some weird fixation on elephants. Kid loves elephants. Got pictures all over his walls. Watches wildlife videos and so on. And what the senator would really like is one of those first-class 4-star African safaris so he can take his grandson to see a bunch of elephants. No problem. Then he decides that the entire family would enjoy such a trip, so our lobbyist arranged the damn thing. 28 people, 2 private jets, 15 days in the African bush drinking Dom Perignon, eating lobster and steak, and of course gawking at 1,000 elephants. The bill was close to $300,000, and he never had a clue it was paid for by me. A bargain. An absolute bargain. He buried the EPA and they fled Beaumont. They couldn't touch us. And as a side benefit, Senator Rudd is now an expert on all issues dealing with Africa. AIDS, genocide, famine, human rights abuses, you name it. And he's an expert because he spent 2 weeks in the Kenyan outback watching wild game from the back of a Land Rover. They shared a laugh and made the first advance upon the noodles. "Did you ever contact him when the lawsuit started?" Barry asked. "No. The lawyers took over with a vengeance. I remember one conversation with Gabbard about Rudd, but it was the combined wisdom back then that politics would not mix with the litigation. We were pretty confident. How wrong we were." They ate for a few minutes, but neither seemed thrilled with the food. "Our boy's name is Ron Fisk," Barry said as he handed over a large manila envelope. "Here are the basics, some photos, a background check. No more than 8 pages at your request." "Fisk?" "That's him." Brianna's mother was in the area, her twice-yearly drop-in, and for such visits, Carl insisted that they use the mansion in the Hamptons and leave him alone in the city. His mother was 2 years younger than Carl and fancied herself attractive enough to catch his eye. He spent less than an hour a year in her presence, and each time caught himself practically praying that Brianna had a different set of genes. He loathed the woman. The mother of a trophy wife is not automatically a trophy mother-in-law, and she is usually much too enamored with the topic of money. Carl had loathed each of his mothers-in-law. He detested the very notion that he had a mother-in-law in the first place. So they were gone. The Fifth Avenue penthouse was all his. Brianna had loaded up Sadler McGregor, the Russian nanny, her assistant, her nutritionist, and a maid or two, and headed out in a small caravan to the island, where she could invade their fine home up there and abuse the staff. Carl stepped from his private elevator, came face to face with abused Imelda, cursed at the sight of her, ignored his valet, dismissed the rest of the staff, and when he was finally alone in the wonderful privacy of his bedroom, he put on his pajamas, a bathrobe, and heavy wool socks. He found a cigar, poured a single malt, and stepped out onto the small terrace overlooking Fifth Avenue and Central Park. The air was raw and windy. Perfect. Reinhardt had cautioned him against fretting the details of the campaign. "You don't want to know everything," he said more than once. "Trust me, this is my profession, and I'm very good at what I do." But Reinhardt had never lost $1 billion. According to one newspaper article, about Carl, no less, only 6 other men had ever lost $1 billion in one day. Barry would never know the humiliation of falling so fast and so hard in this city. Friends become harder to find. Carl's jokes were not funny. Certain portions of the social circuit seemed to be closed, though he knew this was ever so temporary. Even his wife seemed a bit colder and less fawning, not to mention the cold shoulders from those who really mattered.
The bankers, fund managers, investment gurus, the elite of Wall Street. As the wind reddened his cheeks, he looked slowly around at the buildings up and down Fifth Avenue. Billionaires everywhere. Did anyone feel sorry for him? Or were they delighted at his fall? He knew the answer, because he had taken so much delight when others had stumbled. Keep laughing, boys, he thought with a long pull on the malt. Laugh your asses off, because I, Carl Trudeau, now have a new secret weapon. His name is Ron Fisk, a nice, gullible young man purchased offshore by me for chump change. 3 blocks to the north, at the top of a building Carl could barely see, was the penthouse of Pete Flint, one of his many enemies. 2 weeks earlier, Pete had made the cover of Hedge Fund Reports, dressed in an ill-fitting designer suit. He was obviously gaining weight. The story raved about Pete and his fund, and in particular, a spectacular final quarter last year, thanks almost solely to his shrewd shorting of Crane Chemical. Pete claimed to have made $500 million on Crane because of his brilliant prediction that the trial would end badly. Carl's name wasn't mentioned. It wasn't necessary. It was common knowledge that he'd lost $1 billion, and there was Pete Flint claiming to have raked in half of it. The humiliation was beyond painful. Mr. Flint knew nothing about Mr. Fisk. By the time he heard his name, it would be too late, and Carl would have his money back, plus a lot more. Chapter 15. The winter meeting of the Mississippi Trial Advocates, MTA, was held each year in Jackson, in early February, while the legislature was still in session. It was usually a weekend affair with speeches, seminars, political updates, and the like. Because the Paytons currently had the hottest verdict in the state, the trial lawyers wanted to hear from them. Mary Grace demurred. She was an active member, but it wasn't her scene. The gatherings typically included long cocktail hours and war stories from the trenches. Girls were not excluded, but they didn't exactly fit in either. And someone needed to stay home with Mac and Liza. Wes reluctantly volunteered. He, too, was an active member, but the winter meetings were usually boring. The summer conventions at the beach were more fun and family-oriented, and the Payton clan had attended 2 of them. Wes drove to Jackson on a Saturday morning and found the mini-convention at a downtown hotel. He parked far away so none of his fellow trial lawyers would see what he was driving these days. They were noted for their flashy cars and other toys, and Wes, at the moment, was embarrassed by the ragged Taurus that had survived the trip from Hattiesburg. He would not spend the night because he could not afford $100 for a room. It could be argued that he was a millionaire in someone's calculation, but 3 months after the verdict, he was still squeezing every dime. Any payday from the Bowmore mess was a distant dream. Even with the verdict, he still questioned his sanity in getting involved with the litigation. Lunch was in the grand ballroom with seating for 200, an impressive crowd. As the preliminaries dragged on, Wes, from his seat on the dais, studied the crowd. Trial lawyers, always a colorful and eclectic bunch. Cowboys, rogues, radicals, long hairs, corporate suits, flamboyant mavericks, bikers, deacons, good old boys, street hustlers, pure ambulance chasers, faces from billboards and yellow pages and early morning television. They were anything but boring. They fought among themselves like a violent family, yet they had the ability to stop bickering, circle the wagons, and attack their enemies. They came from the cities where they feuded over cases and clients, and they came from the small towns where they honed their skills before simple jurors, reluctant to part with anyone's money. Some had jets and buzzed around the country piecing together the latest class action in the latest mass tort. Others were repulsed by the mass tort game and clung proudly to the tradition of trying legitimate cases one at a time. The new breed were entrepreneurs who filed cases in bulk and settled them that way, rarely facing a jury. Others lived for the thrill of the courtroom. A few did their work in firms where they pooled money and talent, but firms of trial lawyers were notoriously difficult to keep together. Most were lone gunmen, too eccentric to keep much of a staff. Some made millions each year, others scraped by. Most were in the $250,000 range. A few were broke at the moment. Many were up one year and down the next, always on the roller coaster and always willing to roll the dice. If they shared anything, it was a streak of fierce independence and the thrill of representing David against Goliath. On the political right, there is the establishment, the money, and big business, and the myriad groups it finances. On the left, there are the minorities, labor unions, school teachers, and the trial lawyers. Only the trial lawyers have money, and it's pocket change compared with big business. Though there were times when Wes wanted to choke them as a whole, he felt at home here. These were his colleagues, his fellow warriors, and he admired them. They could be arrogant, bullish, dogmatic, and they were often their own worst enemies. But no one fought as hard for the little guy. As they lunched on cold chicken and even colder broccoli, the chairman of the Legislative Affairs Committee delivered a rather bleak update on various bills that were still alive over at the Capitol. The tort reformers were back and pushing hard to enact measures designed to curtail liability and close courthouse doors. He was followed by the chairman of political affairs, who was more upbeat. Judicial elections were in November, and though it was too early in the year to be sure, it appeared as though their good judges at both the trial and the appellate levels would not draw serious opposition. After frozen pie and coffee, Wes Peyton was introduced and received a rousing welcome. He began by apologizing for the absence of his co-counsel, the real brains behind the Bowmore litigation. She hated to miss the event, but believed she was needed more at home with the kids. Wes then launched into a long recap of the Baker trial, the verdict, and the current state of other lawsuits against Crane Chemical. Among such a crowd, a $41 million verdict was a much-revered trophy, and they could have listened for hours to the man who obtained it. Only a few had felt firsthand the thrill of such a victory, and all of them had swallowed the bitter pill of a bad verdict. When he finished, there was another round of boisterous applause, then an impromptu question-and-answer session. Which experts had been effective? How much were the litigation expenses? Wes politely refused to give the amount. Even in a room of big spenders, the sum was too painful to discuss. What was the status of settlement talks, if any? How would the class action affect the defendant? What about the appeal? Wes could have talked for hours and kept his audience. Later that afternoon, during an early cocktail hour, he held court again, answering more questions, deflecting more gossip. A group that was circling a toxic dump in the northern part of the state descended on him and wheedled advice. Would he take a look at their file? Recommend some experts? Come visit the site? He finally escaped by going to the bar, and there he bumped into Barbara Mellinger, the savvy and battle-weary executive director of the MTA and its chief lobbyist.
"Got a minute?"
she asked, and they retreated to a corner where no one could hear them.
"I've picked up a frightening rumor," she said, sipping gin and watching the crowd.
Mellinger had spent 20 years in the halls of the Capitol and could read the terrain like no other, and she was not prone to gossip. She heard more than anyone, but when she passed along a rumor, it was usually more than just that.
"They're coming after McCarthy," she said.
"They?" Wes was standing next to her, also watching the crowd.
"The usual suspects. Commerce Council and that group of thugs."
"They can't beat McCarthy."
"Well, they can certainly try."
"Does she know it?" Wes had lost interest in his diet soda.
"I don't think so. No one knows it."
"Do they have a candidate?"
"If they do, I don't know who it is. But they have a knack for finding people to run."
What exactly was Wes supposed to say or do? Campaign funding was the only defense, and he couldn't contribute a dime.
Do these guys know?
He asked, nodding at the little pockets of conversation.
Not yet. We're lying low right now, waiting. McCarthy typically has no money in the bank. The Supremes think they're invincible, above politics and all that, and by the time an opponent pops up, they've been lulled to sleep.
You got a plan?
No, it's wait and see for now, and pray that it's only a rumor. 2 years ago in the McIlwain race, they waited until the last minute to announce, and by then, they had $1 million plus in the bank.
But we won the race.
Indeed. But tell me you were not terrified.
Beyond terrified.
An aging hippie with a ponytail lurched forward and boomed,
"Y'all kick the asses down there!"
His opening gave every impression that he would consume at least the next half hour of Wes's life. Barbara began her escape.
"To be continued," she whispered.
Driving home, Wes savored the occasion for a few miles, then slipped into a dark funk over the McCarthy rumor. He kept nothing from Mary Grace, and after dinner that night, they slipped out of the apartment and went for a long walk. Ramona and the children were watching an old movie. Like all good lawyers, they had always watched the Supreme Court carefully. They read and discussed every opinion, a habit they started when their partnership began, and one they clung to with conviction. In the old days, membership on the court changed little. Openings were created by deaths, and the temporary appointments usually became permanent. Over the years, the governors had wisely chosen the fill-ins, and the court was respected. Noisy campaigns were unheard of. The court took pride in keeping politics out of its agenda and rulings. But the genteel days were changing.
"But we beat them with McIlwain," she said more than once.
"By 3,000 votes.
It's a win."
2 years earlier, when Justice Jimmy McIlwain got himself ambushed, the Paytons had been too mired in the Bowmore litigation to contribute financially. Instead, they had devoted what little spare time they had to a local committee. They had even worked the polls on election day.
"We've won the trial, Wes, and we're not losing the appeal," she said.
"Agreed.
It's probably just a rumor."
The following Monday afternoon, Ron and Doreen Fisk sneaked away from Brookhaven and drove to Jackson for a late